You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Yesterday, the U.S. financial markets went into free fall, and $1.2 trillion in U.S. stocks just evaporated after Congress failed to pass the proposed $700 billion bailout package. So what does all of that mean, and where do we go from here? We are joined now from Washington, D.C. by Greg Ipp, the U.S. economics editor for The Economist magazine. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to the show.
Hello, Leonard.
Hi. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, even under these circumstances.
Sure.
Was the failure of Congress to pass the proposed bailout package the main reason for yesterday's market convulsions, or do you think there were other factors involved?
It was one of two reasons, Leonard. The market was already down about 300 or 400 points when the news came out that the bailout was defeated, because over the weekend we got very bad news out of Europe, actually, where a very large Belgian bank needed to be rescued by several governments. A large British lender also got itself into trouble, had to be nationalized by the British government, and a German bank was on the verge of going under. So I think the markets have come to appreciate that this crisis, which began in the U.S. subprime market a couple of years ago, is truly a global crisis now that threatens to sweep a lot of economies in.
Would all of the money for the $700 billion proposed bailout have had to have been borrowed?
Yes, it would, Leonard, because simply we don't have the means right now to raise that money out of incoming tax revenues. And the government is already expected to run a sizable deficit in excess of $400 billion next year. But the way this borrowing would work would be quite different from the traditional borrowing that goes on simply to fund things like Medicare and Medicaid and the Department of Defense. Rather than taking that money and spending it on ongoing operations or new equipment for the Army, the money would be invested in assets which actually pay interest. These are mortgage-backed securities. So in some sense, it would almost be like setting up an investment fund, and it's quite possible that the amount of money that would eventually be spent on the program would be quite small relative to the original $700 billion that was borrowed.
Although that's a gamble we'd have to take. Are the Europeans being more responsive to this crisis than we are?
No, in fact, they've actually been much slower to respond. The European Central Bank, for example, has been much more concerned about inflation and more reluctant to lower interest rates than our Federal Reserve System. And they have sort of, many policymakers in Europe have sort of taken the attitude, well, this was our problem and we should deal with it. When the Treasury announced plans that they would seek this bailout from Congress, they also called their foreign counterparts and urged them to do the same, and were basically given the brush off. But I think that the decline in global markets that's taken place in the last few days and the troubles that other countries' banks have run into has awakened people in those other countries to the fact that it may have started here, but it's now a global problem. And in fact, we saw leaders from the European Union and Germany themselves expressing disappointment that our House of Representatives voted against the bailout package.
Now, what are the main culprits for this current economic crisis? Is it the housing bubble, the credit bubble? What about rising energy prices, the weakness of the dollar, a national debt of over $9 trillion, a $6 trillion trade debt, the cost of conducting two wars? And I probably have left a couple of things out.
It's a bit like one of those Agatha Christie movies where you discover that everybody did it, in fact. I mean, you could start, first of all, with the fact that after the stock market bubble burst about 7 or 8 years ago, a lot of people decided they would put their money into real estate instead, since after all, in the time that they could recall, home prices had never gone down. And when everybody got the same idea, they all kind of rushed into real estate, and a Wall Street that was operating under the same delusion that home prices would never decline was all too happy to finance those loans, many of which were with extremely sloppy underwriting standards. I mean, they reasoned, how can this mortgage ever go bad, because we can always just sell the underlying house for even more than the mortgage is worth. Once home prices started to go down, a lot of those assumptions were disrupted and the mortgage paper began to be defaulted on. And unfortunately, we have this complex new financial system where the mortgages are no longer held by your local community bank but are put into baskets of securities and then chopped up and diced and sold around the world. And it has become very difficult for investors to know exactly who's got the exposure to this so-called toxic mortgage paper and how big that is. And as we've seen one institution succumb after another, first with Bear Stearns and then with Fannie and Freddie and then AIG and Lehman Brothers, investors have sort of taken the attitude of shoot first and ask questions later. And you have seen an extraordinary seize up in the funding markets where big corporations, small businesses, banks, fund themselves on a daily basis simply because people are worried that even lending money for more than a day is dangerous because they don't know who is going to be good for the money a week from now.
Not so long ago, we had banks broken up into commercial banks and savings and loans, and they were limited to specific states. They couldn't expand beyond their local state, and they were more tightly regulated. Do you think this would have happened under the old system?
It probably wouldn't have happened exactly the form we've seen, but I mean, it's important to remember that there have been bubbles and financial crises for about 800 years now, and they always come along in some way, shape, or form because human nature has been more or less unchanged in that entire time. And so if it hadn't happened in this specific form, it would have happened in some other. We did have, after all, the S&L crisis that happened in the late 80s, early 1990s, prior to the removal of the barriers between banks and investment banks. But that said, I think that there was some competitive forces at work where the banks and the investment banks were increasingly invading each other's turf, and CEOs of those companies were measuring their success in terms of how much their stock options were going up in value, and bankers who used to sort of like consider their main goal was to make a loan that got paid back sort of saw their main goal as just transacting a lot of loans because their view was they could always like move it off the balance sheet and make a new loan if things went wrong. So everybody sort of got caught up in that excitement, and it's probably clear that the regulatory apparatus and the attention of our regulators was not fully keeping pace with the rate of a new business being created on Wall Street.
Data just released today found that housing values plummeted 16.3% this past July from a year earlier. Given this economic slowdown, are housing prices likely to go even lower?
They probably are, Leonard. I mean, home prices got very high relative to their fundamentals, things such as the cost of renting a similar property or the income of the average family. And even though prices are now down about 20% from the peak, they've only retraced about half to three-quarters of that overvaluation, if you will, relative to rents and incomes. But that said, there are some positive signs. Although prices are declining, they are declining at a slower rate. And the forecasters who look at these things carefully think that within a year they will have bottomed out. And if that happens, then the rate of default on mortgages will also slow. The wild card here is that because we have a financial crisis raging on right now, is that the seize up in lending might make it impossible for people who are quite willing to buy a house to actually get a loan, even if they're actually what in normal times would be considered a highly creditworthy borrower. And if that were to happen, then we could see the economy get much worse. We would see loans that would otherwise be quite good loans become impaired, and the housing market would have to fall much further than it otherwise would.
But what about some of the other economic indicators, like the unemployment rate and real wages? What do they say about the health of the U.S. economy?
The unemployment rate at a little over 6% is actually lower than it was in the wake of the last recession, and we haven't even had a significant quarterly decline in real economic output yet. And in fact, until recently, there was a vigorous debate going on among economists about whether, in fact, we were even in a recession or whether it would be one. I think it's safe to say that debate has, if it's not entirely over, it's close to being over, and it's shifted, unfortunately, in favor of those who think we are in a recession or soon will be in a recession, because we've had an enormous shock to the financial system here, which even if this bailout package is passed in some other form or other rescues come into play, there's just enormous trauma among the lenders and the people who make the decisions about who gets credit and who doesn't get credit for a living. And in the face of that kind of a shock, the natural tendency is for people to disengage and to not take risks. So you'll see banks less willing to make loans and companies less willing to make investments or to hire people. So even in a best-case scenario, there's some very tough slogging ahead of us here.
Well, today is also the deadline for many of the hedge funds that offer quarterly redemptions to pay investors who want to pull out their money. Do we know what's happening with U.S. hedge funds right now? And adding to that, Reuters is reporting that Asian hedge funds are particularly vulnerable today because in times of crisis, investors usually leave emerging markets.
Yeah, the hedge fund situation is yet another sort of manifestation of one of the things that got us into this mess, which is basically high degrees of leverage. Firms that would take a dollar of equity and add another, you know, $10 to $100 of borrowed money and invest it all in the markets, which was a great strategy when markets were going up because it meant that you multiplied your initial investment many times over. But unfortunately, it takes only a very small decline in the prices of the assets that you own to wipe your equity out. And that's what we saw within the investment banks and with some of the hedge funds. And even those hedge funds have had successful couple of years are now going back to their brokers, and the brokers are saying, we don't want to lend you as much money as we used to because we're afraid that even if you're not in trouble now, you're going to be in trouble later. And hedge funds faced with that situation, it's basically like having their loan called on them. They have to sell some of their assets to repay the money. That has the risk of just adding to the fire sale of assets that's going on.
At the end of last year, the three lenders that are now the largest in U.S. banking, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Citigroup, collectively held 21.4% of all U.S. deposits. That's a little over a fifth. Now, with this month's government-backed sales of the banking assets of Washington Mutual and J.P. Morgan to J.P. Morgan and Wachovia to Citigroup, the big three hold a combined 31.3%, almost a third of U.S. deposits. What do you think the impact of this rapid consolidation of banking and financial industries will be, and what happens if one of them fails?
Well, it's an interesting point. I think it's something policymakers have to think carefully about. And if I may, those numbers you've presented actually understate the degree of concentration, because in the process, J.P. Morgan acquired Bear Stearns and Bank of America acquired Merrill Lynch. So their actual footprint in terms of the financial system is even larger than it would be if you just looked at the deposits. Yes, essentially, in the name of saving the financial system, we have created three large companies that, if they weren't too big to fail before, they certainly are now. And I think that once this crisis blows over, one of two things is going to happen. Either the government will have to take measures to try and reduce the size of some of these behemoths down to a size where neither of them, none of them threatens the economy in the event they fail, or there will have to be some sort of new structure of regulation imposed upon them, which is much more stringent and hands-on than has been the case even in the past, simply because the consequences of one of them taking excessive risks would be too great for the economy to bear.
I've been talking with Greg Ipp, the U.S. economics editor for The Economist magazine. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We have a link to more of WNYC's economic coverage on our show page at WNYC.org. Check it out to keep up with the latest news on this financial crisis. Up next, Roy Orbison's widow, Barbara, on her late husband's many hit records over his four-decade career and how he coped with some horrible personal tragedies in the midst of that success. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Now, our whole show is available as a podcast.